a station with only like 500 watts might not cover, you know, downtown Chico, but a station of like 50,000 watts would take it quite far. So the wattage you can get is based on the sort of license that you're granted by the FCC.
And what does KCFR have?
You know, off the top of my head, I don't quite remember. Shame on me, but it's, yeah.
Okay, let me ask you this. How far away can people hear us?
It's pretty sweet. So you can hear us on 90.1 FM just north of the Sacramento airport.
Oh.
So you can pull out of the Sacramento airport, you head a couple miles on 5 or on 99, and you'll be able to pick us up right there. And then on the other end of Chico, you can hear us as far north as somewhere like Anderson, around that area. When it comes to east and west, we've had people that have been able to pick us up as far as Clear Lake. You know, sometimes that's weather dependent. You know, if there's fog, it'll carry farther and that kind of stuff, and sort of how the radio waves like ride inside the canyon.
Oh, that's interesting.
You know, so yeah, we've heard that we can go as far west as Clear Lake, but we're always available on our mobile apps, iPhone, Android, and also you can stream us on our main website as well.
During the pledge drive, sometimes people will call in from Arizona when I've been here, from different states, because they're listening online.
It's a blessing. It's a blessing. We're totally thankful for it, too. Sometimes those folks are people who used to live in Chico and used to listen to KZFR, and then they moved. Sometimes they're friends of DJ, and then other times they stumbled across us, whether on the internet or like a tune-in radio, and they found like, oh, I like Kelp music. Oh, this show's on this station. Oh, whoa. And then sometimes it's organic like that.
I know a board member told me that she would like to have more news. I mean, there's Amy Goodman every morning at 8. There's some programs about social issues like mine and the Wednesday one. What other plans do you have for new social kind of issues programs?
Well, one of the ways that you and I met today, as we do whenever you have your program, is because I do new program orientations, so I can train people from the community to come in and learn how to be a broadcaster here on the station. So we're always looking for folks in the community who are interested in, say, a specific topic, whether it's, you know, you're going to talk about DACA today. Mm-hmm. So that could be, you know, a whole radio show within itself for 30 minutes every week. Some people are more into, like, environmental issues or, say, animal issues, and so they'll go through the training and then propose a program for what they're into. And then, you know, we always like to support the community thoughts and the community organizations in town, and also any of the voices that our community has as well. So we're always open to new stuff.
I know there's a Hmong language program Sunday
That's
morning.
Correct.
Is there a Spanish language
That's
program?
That's correct. I believe the Hmong show is on Saturday mornings, and we have a Spanish-speaking show on Sundays.
What time is that?
I believe it's early. I believe on Sundays it starts at 7 a.m.
Oh, my goodness.
That's early, that's early to me.
Is there anything that you'd like to say to listeners about how to contribute?
Well, first and foremost, I'd like to thank everyone for contributing during our pledge drive.
Which was very successful.
It was very successful, and we wouldn't have been able to do it without y'all. And I'd like to thank out the underwriters as well for helping us out. But if you're ever so inclined to make us a donation, it's as simple as you can go to our website, kzfr.org. Safe and secure, using PayPal, you can make a donation that way of everything from 75 cents to $750 or even a dollar. Whatever you want to give, we're all appreciate it. And then you can also support us by attending some of our fundraisers that we have coming up.
There's lots of them.
Lots
of music events at the Women's Club. They're really hot.
True. Tomorrow we have Joe Craven and the Sometimers doing songs from their Garcia songbook. And then the week after that we've got Daryl Scott. And then in December we got a New Year's Eve party and a holiday party. So you can always support us by partying with us.
what a hardship. And we should also congratulate Grant, because he's recently newly married to a really wonderful woman, a teacher.
Thank you.
She's super.
She is great. Big up Molly. I know she's listening. Yeah.
Anything else you want to say?
No. I hope you have a great show, Gail.
All right.
I'd like to know what everyone's going to be talking about.
We're talking about growing up Chicano.
I like it.
All righty. So if you just tuned in, you're listening to Ask Dr. Gail, KZFR. We're on the second Thursday of each month. And next month, I don't believe it, but it's December already, and we're going to talk about the meaning of Jesus. So I have someone from LDS, and I have someone, I'm working on a Catholic, and we have someone who's more Protestant. It's going to be an interesting show. Okay, so the show tonight is about growing up Chicano. And let's start by introducing the panel. So we have Paul Lopez, who's professor at Chico State. And we have Carlos. Oh, I know, we also do I videotape and put it on my YouTube channel so that the shows last forever and ever and ever. So we have Carlos, and we have Maria, and we have Karina, and the three students are DACA students. So that's really pertinent, again, in terms of the Supreme Court decision. So let's start out with labels. We know that there's a whole bunch of different ones. You can call yourself Latino, Latina, Chicano, Chicana, Latin, Latinx, Mestizo, Nicantica. Did I leave anything out? Let's just go down the line. How do you identify yourself if someone says, what's your background?
For me, it's I identify as Chicano since I grew up in the 60s and 70s and developed what I would call a political consciousness as I became a college student. And so I've used that ever since. And occasionally I will call myself Latino because it might depend upon who I'm interacting with and trying to explain what a Chicano is to someone from outside California, for example, might be problematic. So the broader term Latino seems to fit.
And did you, your graduate education, your education is in the Midwest. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Santa Barbara. So I'm from California. Got my bachelor's degree at Cal State Northridge in Chicano Studies. Got my master's in sociology from Notre Dame. And then got my PhD from Northeastern University in Boston.
That was a culture shock, right?
Every step of the way was a culture shock, absolutely, yeah.
You know, Art Sanchez, who teaches in psych at Chico State, also grew up in Santa Barbara, and his family has been there for generations and generations. So this notion that Chicanos just came over the border yesterday, no, a lot of were here before any Anglos came here.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. We still identify with the Southwest or California as our home territory, yeah.
So what was there about your family background that led you to be a PhD?
You know, it was probably instilled from my parents that as long as they sacrificed for us, that we would excel in education. And so
everybody's heads are nodding.
And my father in particular was probably university bound, but he had a different direction because of his experience in Mexico, which is ironic because he was born in the U.S., but that's a whole different story. But my dad was pretty important to all three of us. I have two other siblings who also went to higher education. My sister's a nurse, and my brother is an architect, and he also went to Berkeley, for example. And,
wow.
As long as we did well, they supported us all the way through, you know, paid rent, paid part of our tuition, etc. But we were fortunate as compared to students today here at the CSUs because we were actually paid most of our fees by the state at that point. So
tuition was really cheap.
Yeah, absolutely. And so it was fairly easy to get your education back there without getting too much into debt. And but again, it was probably my parents who were primarily instrumental in pushing us or telling us to stay in school.
It's interesting because it used to be that Mexican-American families would often emphasize the kids should work and that school, we don't do that. We have to bring in money to support the family. And especially for girls, we do not want them going away to another campus away from home. So that's really changed because now Chico State's a third Latinx, so that's a big shift. What do you think caused that?
Well, in my case, my parents, you know, working class family. My dad was a custodian. My mom was a maid at UC Santa Barbara.
Mm.
And
my alma mater.
There you go. And so they just, you know, emphasized us as long as we were doing well in school, don't worry about, you know, having to get a job. I mean, we worked part-time jobs while we were going to school, especially in Santa Barbara, but
oh, yeah.
Other than that, as long as we were doing well, and in my case, I just, you know, the the idea of just finishing my education was just important. And by the time I was a junior, I pretty much had settled on becoming a professor. So in my case, I just studied and studied as much as I could every day, and started getting straight A's, and eventually got into a graduate program. And I was very fortunate to have mentors as well when I was in graduate school to see that I could finish the programs. And so I was very fortunate. I had really good mentors when I was in graduate school as well. And again, back to my parents, they were the key, definitely.
Why did you pick Chicano Studies and not be a doctor, a lawyer, or something else?
To this day, I just kind of live and breathe it. You know, it's just something that has been instilled with me. I first started taking a couple courses at the community college in Santa Barbara, but once I transferred to Cal State Northridge, which has the largest Chicano Studies program in the country, it was just... that was it for me. I just truly lived and breathed it for the 2.5 years that I was there, and I just couldn't get any more. And so when I started thinking about graduate school, there were not any graduate programs in Chicano Studies at that time. And so I had to find an alternative. And I was very fortunate to find my mentor, Dr. Samora, who was immigration specialist, probably the most well-known immigration specialist. I wrote him a letter saying I wanted to go to school there.
At Northwestern.
Northeastern. I'm sorry. No. At
Notre Dame.
And so he wrote back to me and sent an application, and I applied and I got in. And so that just reaffirmed the fact that I wanted to stay in Chicano Studies indefinitely. And then the second time for my PhD, the same thing occurred. I went to Northeastern. Had a Puerto Rican professor who had just arrived there too, and so I continued to train with him, and I've never looked back. It's just been a fascinating discipline for me to stay in touch with.
Yeah, good. Carlos, what about you? What identifier do you like, and where did you grow up?
For me, it's a little confusing because, as you know, I'm a DACA recipient, so I was raised in the U.S., but I was actually born in Mexico. But like, I feel like American, like everybody else. So I mean, I'm into like Hispanic, Latino. Use those identifiers, and Chicano, I could say as well. But then on paper, I'm technically not Chicano. But
why
the U.S.? Well, I feel like Chicano is someone, I guess, second generation that was born here, but they have like people from Mexico or from any Latin American country. As you know, I wasn't born here technically, but I feel like American, so I guess I could say I could be Mexican American too. But yeah.
How old were you when you came to the U.S.?
I came here when I was 7 years old, so it was a big change for me, coming from a different country, not knowing the language. But I mean, it was, I suppose, I went as well through a culture shock. I learned the language. I'm in Chico State. So, I mean, I did all the things that all the kids did back in the day, all American TV shows, movies, but yeah. And what was the other question?
Well, where did, when you came at age 7, where did you go? What city?
Oh, okay. So I was raised in San Diego, California. So there was a lot of other Hispanics there, Latinos, Chicanos. So it wasn't as bad, but a lot of the times it was like a person coming from Mexico, they see you, they kind of like, you feel like an outcast for a second at schools. But
even with Latino,
yeah,
students,
even within the,
oh, because you're the
own race,
low pecking order.
Yeah,
the new chicken in the flock.
Yeah, that's exactly how it is. But you know, for me it was just like my parents did a lot for me, so like they gave me this opportunity to learn and have an education. So I was able to pull through, I guess, but yeah.
And then are you at Chico State, what are you majoring in?
I studied computer science, actually, so it's like totally different from Chicano studies, but I try to get involved in a lot of activism in Chico. So that has come, a lot of my education comes from a lot of my peers and that I have been involved with, And I've also taken a Chicano Studies class too as a GE course. So, yeah.
And why did you pick Chico State coming from San Diego?
Well, one of the things I wanted to get away from home.
Sure, it's an education.
I wanted to get away from home.
It's
and,
an education.
I also wanted to get out from that bubble there and where I lived. So I wanted to, I guess it's the closest thing for me to travel the world, even though I can't really travel around as much. Oh, excuse me. But so yeah, going from Southern California to Chico, it's like 10 hours away at least. So it's a lot of diversity in California. So it seemed like I'm traveling to another state.
Yeah.
But yeah, I liked it here because also the college town, it was right for me. And affordable. So it's gonna be, it's hard to get a lot of money as a DACA recipient, so a lot of the times I was able to come here was from private scholarship, that was also like a way for me to come here because financially and getting away from home, I suppose, are the main things.
I really think that going away from home to college is half the education,
right?
I went to Berkeley and I learned so much being in a big international school like mm-hmm. that was an education in itself. So your parents are undocumented?
Yeah.
Do they have to like tiptoe around, or what's the environment like now for them?
First of all, I want to thank my parents because they pretty much left, like at my age, they left pretty much their everything behind at my age. And they do feel scared, but at the same time, like, I don't know if they try to hide it. They, for us, so they feel like strong, like, oh, I'm going to work for you. We're going to do this, so don't worry about us. Just to, like, give us support. I don't know if it's just, like, a parent thing, like, they don't want their children to see, like, oh, like, I'm not doing well. But I try to, like, help them out. Of course, I will, like, anything happens to my parents, I will do anything I can in my power to, like, you know, help them out. So they actually have come to Chico like to visit me. So we try to like, I tell them like, not worry about it or anything. What's going to happen is going to happen. And they have a lot of faith as well. So I guess they will say like, it's God's will, God's plan, to do what's going to happen to them. It's going to happen. So
as a DACA recipient, you can't like go visit grandmother in Mexico or something
I can't.
Right? Yeah.
I think there's some cases that some DACA recipients have, but it was like super strict and it was like for a particular reason they can go. So I feel like it was if their like grandmother was like about to like pass out for final moments or something like that.
And in this administration, you don't want to take the chance.
And a lot of times you don't have guaranteed you're going to be able to come back in. So
No. Maria, tell us your identifier and where you grew up.
Hi, thank you for having us here.
Thank you.
I identify as Hispanic or Latina. I grew up in Santa Barbara County as well.
Where?
Santa Maria area. So very, not very diverse there. Pretty much everyone there is pretty much Hispanic or Latino. And so it's very agriculture. Environment.
And how did you get to Chico State?
I applied to their program strictly because a friend applied, and they're like, "Oh, let's apply to the same colleges." So I did, and then I had like the 4 fee waivers, so I was like, "Why not?" From the College Board, so I applied to Chico, got in. They were the ones that offered me the best financial aid packet, which for me that was the deciding factor. And so
you have to eat.
That was pretty much it. And they have a great engineering program.
And what are you majoring in?
Civil engineering.
I love it. I did a panel on this show on women in non-traditional careers. Mm-hmm. And you know what was interesting is most of them were firstborn. What's your birth order?
Firstborn.
What's yours, Paul?
Second generation.
Of your siblings, who came?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm the third.
What about you, Carlos?
Yeah, I'm the youngest third.
Okay. And then what year in school are you in?
And this is my last semester.
All right.
Yes.
Oh, that's so exciting. Mm-hmm. And what roughly percent of the engineering students are female?
Ooh, good question. Very low percentage. I don't know.
Maybe. I mean, when you go to a class.
Oh, very low. Maybe it's like, it depends on the class, but for example, if we have a lab, say, I don't know. It still depends on the class too. There's a lot more women in like environmental engineering and classes and stuff like that. Whereas civil or structural, there's a little less, or mechanical engineering, there's less females, but maybe like, I don't know, 5 to 20, I don't know.
And what gave you the oomph to do it when you're a fish swimming against the stream, in a way?
It was mainly, since I am the first child, the first of, you know, my entire family to leave to college, even pursue an education, period. I thought, I need a degree. I need to get a degree that when I'm out of college, I have a job for sure. It's secure.
You will, too.
And that was my main motivator. And then, as well, just to be able to show my parents, hey, you know, everything you did for me, look at it. It worked out. All your sacrifices, they're reflected right here. And so, and to be able to show my siblings, like, it's possible, you know? And so that was my...
What made you think of it?
What made me... Okay, so in junior high, I have always been very involved in different clubs since like junior high, but I have always been involved in clubs and in different organizations. And I joined the MESA program in our junior high school. And we went to competitions, build popsicle bridges, manila file folder bridges. I placed in both of the competitions, both 7th and 8th grade. And I was like, hey, and one of my professors, my math professor, came up to me, he's like, you know what? You're really good at math. You placed. You seem to have fun. Did you have fun? I was like, yes, I did. He's like, you know, you can make a career out of this. And I was like, oh, really? And then from there. So it's mentors, people in my life.
That is so true.
Who saw potential. Because other than that, you know, I didn't have much, you know, anybody else to look to.
And yeah, studies show that first generation college students struggle.
Yeah.
Because the basic things about, you know, in high school, you got to take the SATs, mm-hmm. and you've got to apply this way, and you got to apply for the dorm and things that. How are you supposed to know that?
Yeah,
and yeah. In big high schools, the counselors aren't holding your hand, probably.
I was very lucky, actually. My high school, I joined the AVID program, Advanced Via Individual Determination, and that program basically, I had the 30 students in my class had one counselor. That counselor saw all of us. And our all 4 years, so she was with us every step of the way.
And who was the target audience? Just like people,
first generation,
any background. If you're first generation,
yeah. And so, obviously, good grades. That, I think that was the main focus. That I all throughout high school, I was involved with different clubs and organizations who. Not necessarily were catering for me as a DACA, but they were catering for me as a first generation. So I was able to get information through them, and that kind of paved the way of what I had to do because I had the right resources.
And are there private scholarships for DACA students?
Yes.
And then do those come from churches, or who do they tend to come from?
Yeah, they come from like private organization, private groups who want to donate to all students. Basically, it's they take away that requirement of a citizenship. And so if they're not checking that, then that makes you eligible to apply.
Yep.
And then in terms of, like if you have to write down a social security number, people want to identify you by mm-hmm. your little number, how does one cope with that?
Well, as DACA, we do get a social security number. It's restricted to employment only, but we can use it... like here, we use it for Chico for financial aid.
Oh, got it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm not going to show Karina on the video. So, Karina, tell us how you identify and where you were born and where you grew up and all that juicy stuff.
Awesome. Thank you for having me as well.
My
it's really
pleasure.
Great to have this discussion open for us.
Yes.
I identify as Latinx because as well, like, this new generation coming in, like, inclusivity is something we want to keep open just for many people in general, because it's a lot of people who identify in a different sort of the common male and female. I was born in Mexico, and I right after I was born, honestly, my mom, you know, my parents brought me over to America, and we went straight to my grandma's, because my grandma already lived in East LA. Mm. So that's where I lived till I was 6 years old. Mm. And from there, my mom...
So you came as a baby?
Yeah.
Ah.
Yeah. And then my mom decided that she didn't like the neighborhood we were at, and then so they decided to come to NorCal. So I am... Basically, I was raised in NorCal. I'm not that far from Chico. And yeah, that's where...
And are you at Chico State?
I am at Chico State.
What are you majoring in?
English education.
So is that like English for non-speakers, that you teach them English, kind of an ESL kind of a thing?
That's also a pathway that I'm... that's a certificate that I'm going into as well, as an English education, because I want to teach English literature in middle school and high school. Uh-huh. Depending, I'm still not sure which one yet, but those are my targets.
I've done both.
Ooh.
It's a lot of paper correcting.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I love it.
Oh, good. 5 classes a day. It's a lot of paper correcting if you're a good English teacher.
Yeah, I think. I just, like, all the educators in my life have been motivators as well. Like, my parents, of course. But just education to me has always been important. It's been my main focus. My parents didn't really, like... They've always said that it's, like, it's my life, so if I want to continue education, I can. So they brought up that you can either work or get an education. You're here, you have the opportunity, so whatever pathway you do, just make sure you choose one. And my goal has always been education, and all the professors and teachers I've had have been a great role model and example. I haven't had, like, a horrible experience with any educator. So I just, like, I owe it back to them, and I really want to give back for other people like me who are looking to that pathway for college. That's, it's obtainable. It's something you can do. So that's...
But, it really has changed just in a few decades, where there were hardly any Hispanics. When you came, Dr. Lopez, to Chico State, do you know what percent of the student body was Latinx?
I think it was probably 7%.
Yeah.
Somewhere around that percentage.
Yeah.
It was very small.
Yeah.
Very small.
And so something's happened. Do you have a sense of what caused that shift? Was it because of the education institutions reached out, or something, cultural change in Hispanic culture? Or what do you think went from 7% to 33%?
Well, I think it was predominantly the HSI affiliation, or Hispanic Serving Institution, was a primary focus.
What's that?
That's where the federal government will fund you if you reach a certain percentage of students, and I think the percentage was 25% or more if your campus has Hispanic
students. Oh, it's a
students.
Money thing.
Right, yeah. So that occurred probably a few years ago, and so as a result, they went out, and of course, and recruited.
How interesting.
Latino students to come, yep.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, I didn't know that. That's fascinating. We're going to thank our underwriters. Ask Dr. Gale is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Friends of the Arts, your state local partner to the California Arts Council. Since 2001, Friends of the Arts has been creating economic opportunity by producing and supporting events and spreading the word out about arts and culture through their bi-monthly newsletters. To stay in the know about the arts or have your event listed, visit friendsof.art, and stay in touch. Ask Dr. Gale is also brought to you by the Zeppelin Works, specializing in Volkswagen, BMW, Porsche, my dream car, Audi, Volvo, and Mercedes since 1981. Not that I would get one. The Zeppelin Works is a full-service repair facility for any European automotive problems or maintenance. More information can be gained by calling 893-0757 or zeppelinworks.com. And Ask Dr. Gale is made possible by the Chico Paper Company, a family-owned cornerstone of downtown Chico for over 40 years, located right beneath us at 4th and Broadway. Chico Paper Company features an on-site custom framing studio and art gallery showing the largest selection of local and regional artists. Chico Paper Company can be reached by calling 891 0900 or at chicopapercompany.com. Ask Dr. Gale is also brought to you by Advantage Insurance Services. Local independent insurance broker Dave Dalton can provide for all your insurance needs. Advantage Insurance is proud to support KZFR and can be reached at 342-0540. For a quote or more information, visit AdvantageInsuranceChico.com. And just a reminder, we're on the second Thursday of each month, and next month we're going to talk about the meaning of Jesus. And if I can find somebody to talk about Islam and Muhammad, let them know I'd like to include them too. Since we've been talking about DACA and it's so current, let's talk about it. So Obama made the program in 2012. He said it's that you can stay, you can get paperwork, you're not on the path to citizenship, but we're not going to deport you. And then Trump did away with it in 2017. So now the Dreamers of about 700,000, or I've seen 800,000 people, are left in limbo. So the Supreme Court is right now discussing it. So who wants to fill us in on the legal status? What's the Supreme Court deciding? Are we looking at Maria? our engineer?
I guess we're looking at Maria. Let's see how Maria does.
Okay.
So currently they are... November 12th, they had the hearing where they were listening, or the Supreme Court listened to what the community had to say, why DACA should stay, and then they're supposed to give us a kind of an answer as to what the Supreme Court decided, either January or June of 2020.
There's something about a memo that left out something. Do you understand the legal arguments that are being made? Anybody? Mm-hmm. I don't.
It's pretty confusing because, yeah. I mean, we're just students. A lot of the stuff that we're pretty educated in DACA because it's like, it revolves around our lives a lot.
Yeah.
It's pretty complicated thing, like, to argue on court, because a lot of these people are not citizens, but a lot of them just want to, you know, survive, make a living. So I guess the argument is, if you give them a path to citizenship, is that going to affect the economy or have less workers?
But DACA doesn't give a path to citizenship, right?
No, it doesn't.
Yeah. So if someone has DACA status, is there any hope? Or do we just have to wait for a Democratic president?
I guess not. Well, hopefully this could be like a bipartisan thing, because, you know, both houses working together, I feel like a lot of the times it's like politicians are just using us as like to get a vote in a way. But, you know, this is just my opinion as a DACA recipient and trying to follow all politics here and there. And I feel like until the day that both houses can work together, they're probably going to come out to a solution. But I don't know if that's going to happen anytime soon.
Well, we have to vote in a Congress that says, okay, we're not going to kick out 800,000 or 700,000 people who've been here since they were babies or something and don't know any other culture.
Yeah.
So cruel.
Yeah, it is pretty cruel.
Do you have any ideas why Trump has made anti-Hispanic, really, attacks kind of the foundation of his campaigns? Build the wall, make America great again, which means send anybody who's not Anglo back home, essentially. He really likes the Norwegians for some reason. So why do you think that resonates? That's what bothers me. Any ideas about that?
It's like racism.
Honestly, because Trump, of course, is. I mean, I've done my research, but he has shown a lot of racism in his past. Like, there's evidence of racism
with the tenants in his housing.
Exactly. Like, there, he's been doing it all his life, and I feel like that's the only thing he knows. Yeah. And he's aware. He knows. He's aware that there's a lot of Americans who still feel that way. Who still feel that, like, you know. Diversity should not be a thing in America. So I feel like he used it as a platform, knowing that there is a majority of white supremacy still evident in our lives today. So, I mean, yeah, he's been doing it all his life, so I think that's just the perfect, that's his perfect thing that he sees, like, that's my my crowd, that's who I need to be targeting towards. And then, in my opinion, I feel like it's really devastating, because, like, what have we done to you? Like, what did we do, if that makes any sense?
Oh, they worked on his golf courses, did a lot of the work to make his golf courses make money.
Yeah, like, we helped you. Well, you know, my people helped you. We're helping.
His wife's an immigrant. Her parents are immigrants. His third wife. His first wife, too.
And that's the thing. I don't understand. Like, I also don't understand why he's doing what he's doing, but I just know I believe that's all he knows what to do.
You know, I read somewhere that he can't logically remember very much, but he could remember build the wall. Mm-hmm. And so he'd go, build the wall, and those rallies of, you know, bigots would go, yay, build the wall, and then he kept on going, and it just mushroomed. Paul, do you have any wild ideas why that appeals to the something like 40% of Americans who approve of Trump?
Well, I think part of it is the older generation that kind of remains somewhat conservative, that is the generation prior to the baby boomers that are primarily Republican conservative. And so he's linked into that population, as well as I would argue maybe the insecurity that some Americans have in regards to how the economy has changed so dramatically within the last...
For blue-collar workers.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so to cling on to something that makes sense to them in terms of using Latinos or Dreamers or undocumented immigrants as the scapegoat, which has been something very consistent in American society.
And in world history.
Yeah, for example...
You blame someone.
My father's father was here in the... towards the end of the Mexican Revolution, and at that time it was kind of an open border phenomenon, but then the Great Depression came, and so around the early 30s my father, who was born here as well as the majority of his siblings, ended up being back in Mexico as a result of that. And so that's one of many events in American history in which Latinos, in this case people of Mexican origin, have been used as scapegoats. And I think the other thing that's also occurring is, you know, demographically we're changing. We're becoming a browner, darker society.
Yeah.
And that puts a lot of fear into folks who want to romanticize race as a largely white society, which is changing dramatically. And I think for your listeners, you know, the face of America is right next to me. It is Latinos who are going to...
California, Texas, Arizona,
going to be the ones who are going to occupy jobs as educators,
Florida,
or engineers or doctors or nurses. That's the future of America. It's just a reality. And it's not just an American phenomenon. It's a phenomenon happening in Japan, Great Britain.
Of immigrants?
Immigrants, but also an aging society.
Right.
And so...
Especially Japan, yeah.
Yeah. And so, again... Change doesn't come easy, and so I think this is just a continuation of what to expect here in the United States. Hopefully people will, I think the recent polls tend to suggest that most Americans want to support DACA, want to support immigration reform, but things in Washington just don't seem to want to go in that direction for other political reasons. And I would argue Trump is the last person that you want to talk about immigration issues. I don't think he has any background or knowledge of what he's trying to do with the immigration policy.
Well, apparently a guy named Stephen Miller, have you heard of him? Stephen Miller is his immigration advisor, and he's really racist and really anti-immigrant.
Yeah, he was just outed as a white nationalist based upon some email exchanges, like thousands of email exchanges with someone who is really tied to the white nationalist movement here in this country.
Yeah, and he was raised in Santa Monica in California, which is kind of a liberal high school, but somehow he...
No, you trace his history, and he was very anti-Latino back in Santa
Monica. I think
Monica.
He has ancestors who were in the Holocaust,
right.
So and were immigrants to the U.S. So, I mean, he of all people should have some sense of this is a global society. We're moving around, and that's good to keep creativity flowing. I always think it's so interesting when I listen to the radio and they have experts on and they have an Indian accent or Spanish accent or whatever. I think, you know, this is what makes America great. Not saying we only want one kind of person. Yeah.
And if I can add to that, again, demographics are changing in the United States, and we actually need more immigrants to fill some of the jobs
yes.
that aren't being filled. And so
yes.
at a time in which we are trying to be anti-immigrant, the irony is that we actually need them. We need them to compete competitively internationally in a global economy.
Right.
So,
and because older white people don't have as many children, we also need children to keep the birth rate up. Of different backgrounds, so we have people to work and pay into Social Security and all that.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So what we have to hope is that young people vote.
Yes, definitely.
What are you hearing in terms of your peers at school? Because traditionally the problem has been that young people are fairly apathetic politically and they don't vote. Although they have liberal leanings, they're really, this generation, Generation Z and Y, is really inclusive. They don't judge people by their color or their sexual preference or whatever. They don't care, but they don't go out and vote. So are you seeing any changes?
I don't know if I can speak for like a lot of the students around, but I mean, for the people that I'm around with, my peers, they're people that are willing to vote all the time. And I mean, I can't vote, but I couldn't like convince them. Okay.
Yeah. Go and drive them, get them to
yeah.
the polls
yeah.
or whatever.
Yeah. I guess we try to do that because, as you can see, it's pretty important. Even if we disagree with it, it's good to put your voice. I mean, that's the foundation of America. Like, it's for the people, what the people want. And unfortunately, like right here, we have the Electoral College, so it's a little.
That's what elected Trump. It's so sad.
it's a little confusing. But I don't know. I feel like eventually, I have faith that things will turn around. And I know there's a lot of trans supporters that I know as well. I personally know them too, and they're like good people. But I feel like they're not completely educated on politics, and a lot of stuff they hear is like what they go for. Oh, he said this, so I'm gonna vote for him, and. But there's actually good people that are trans reported. They're just not, I would say, educated. And I know it's hard because a lot of the people, they have jobs, they have a family. And for them to, like, spend some time to, you know, try to get into politics, what's going on, what are the policies, it takes a lot. So, and, you know, the media could be also, like, too biased. So it's not easy for them to, I guess.
If they listen to Fox News.
Yeah, it's hard.
Right. Either of you two young, beautiful women want to say anything to add to that about peers and their political activism?
I don't know. I think I just selectively surround myself around people who want to go out there and support. It's not on purpose. It just kind of happens naturally, a natural selection.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I think that a lot of the young people, especially, they notice the change and the effect that it has on their peers. So maybe they're voting more. I don't know.
Well, they did vote more in the last election.
Yeah.
And that got it some liberal state policies in. Mm-hmm. So I think there's an upward trend. Because, mm-hmm. And I think climate change is made... Yeah. Young people think, oh my gosh, this is my future. I better get involved. And our hero, Greta Thunberg.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Local elections will make a difference.
Right. Yeah. Let's talk about some stereotypes and see if they're true or not. One, I think, kind of a nice stereotype is that Latinx families are really family-centered, La Familia. And that's, mm-hmm. you have big family gatherings. And the stereotype that I remember most is seeing the movie When Fools Rush In, and mm-hmm. the Anglo guy, Matthew Perry's character, is so kind of unemotional and so disconnected from his family, and then Selma Hayek's character, her family's all involved, her mm-hmm. brothers, and the movie makes us think that the Mexican-American family is much more loving and warm and engaged yeah. and supportive and interfering and supportive. Do you want to comment on that?
Personally, I honestly believe, well, my family personally, we are really family-oriented. We are. But I do believe it's, like, a lot of the cultures, too. You know, it's a lot of cultures that also, like, have that. But, yeah, I honestly, my family is really family-oriented. Like,
how often do you get together?
Ooh, as much as we can. Because, I mean, my parents do work all the time. My other, like, my parents' brother, my parents' siblings work all the time, too. So we take birthdays very seriously mm. or Christmas gatherings. Mm. That's when it's huge. Like, we really try to put ourselves into a position where we feel comfortable and safe, you know, a moment to be like, we're so thankful that we're here. We're allowed to, you know, do what we're doing and, you know, just thankful for as a family to be together.
So what will you do at Christmas? Like, how many people will come? Do you potluck it? Does one person cook and then you rotate, or how do you organize Christmas?
Personally, my family, we try to, like, we reach out to, like, my whole, so my mom's side of the family, my dad's side of the family, like, we try to, you know, meet in the middle somewhere. But, you know, like, some people, well, personally for me, some of my uncles do go somewhere else because they have other family members as well, you
and
know,
they have wives and stuff.
Wives, yeah. And so, but I mean, with my family, we just try to meet in the middle. And some people can't make it, then we have this thing called, like, recalentada. So, like, it's like the next day, you just, like, reheat the food.
Oh,
and so
yeah.
if they can't make it Saturday, they make it Sunday. You know, like, they come through on Sunday and they, yeah, it's, but I do believe, like, we're really family-oriented personally for me.
Well, you know what my mother did that I try to continue, I do continue, is that she insisted at Christmas dinner that we just didn't have gifts and dinner and food, that everyone talk about the meaning of Christmas mm-hmm. and maybe the kids would play a musical instrument for a Christmas carol. My dad would read The Night Before Christmas. I'd read from Luke about the birth of Jesus. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's an important thing. And I wonder if you do that in your family. You probably go to church too, maybe.
Yeah, Maria? That's something they do in my family. So we, our immediate family, I'm the one that's in charge of the itinerary. So
of course, the engineer.
Yes, of course. So I come up with a list of games, and instead of everyone bringing a gift for each individual bringing a gift for every member of the family, they can. It's open to. It's optional. My brother always wants to give a gift to everyone. But instead of doing that, we do bring a gift that's gender neutral, age neutral. We put it in the table with, like, a bunch of other gifts, and then we play games all throughout the night because, and this is on the 24th, because, of course, we are waiting for the birth of Jesus, and that's when we do the nativity, and we have a tradition where we sing a lullaby to baby Jesus on the time of his birth, so it's 12 o'clock. And then, I don't know.
On midnight?
Yeah,
on the
midnight
24th.
Of the 24th. So that's when we stay up and we wait for that time. And in order to wait for that time, we do all these series of games. And we read and we sing and we dance and we eat. So, yeah.
How fun.
Yeah, very, very fun.
So mm-hmm. roughly how many people will you expect this Christmas?
This Christmas?
On the 24th.
That's where the stereotype doesn't fit me. mine is just my internal family, so not my full family, just parents, my siblings, a lady she's like an aunt, but we're not blood related. Her daughter, and then maybe like two other people that are not related to us. So it's very much just a very small, well, I don't know if it's small. It's about maybe like 10, 15 people.
You don't call that small.
So it's not small. But it's small for a typical, like, Latin or Hispanic family. Because you have the uncles and the cousins and the, you know, wives and the friend of the friend. And that doesn't happen in my household. It's just my family that lives there on the same roof.
And then how do you do the cooking? Because that takes a lot of work.
Yes. So previous years it's just all my mom and myself, yeah. But now we've gone into this tradition where everyone brings something to the table. So in advance we say, okay, you're going to be in charge of the drinks, you're going to be in charge of the you know, main course, which is usually like tamales or pozole or, you know, something traditional like that. And then, like, you bring the dessert, and then so on and so forth.
And would dessert be pie, or is that an Anglo thing?
Yeah, we don't do pie. We do, like, gelatina de mosaico, which is jello, milk. I don't know, milk jello with colored jello pieces.
Oh, yeah.
And flan, choco flan, which is just cake and flan put together. Mm. What other things? Buñuelos. Those are like a flour tortilla, thin flour tortilla, kind of. Deep fried with sugar and cinnamon on top. What else? Champurrado. Which is like a drink, like a hot drink.
And then do you sing Christmas carols?
We sing our typical, like, our folk music.
Las rancheras.
Mariachi.
Very typical, yeah. Like, Mexican mariachi songs and cumbias to dance to.
Yeah,
and
I love cumbia.
But we do sing, like, posada songs, which are, like, go around with the nativity.
Carlos, what about you? La familia.
Well, I would suppose that my family is pretty close and family oriented. I have a family of five, immediate family of five.
The siblings are five?
No.
Three
so
siblings.
I have two siblings, myself and then mom and dad.
Okay.
But yeah, we try to be really family oriented. Whenever someone needs help on something, we help them out. We try to get together as much as we can because I know they have work and then I have school and all that. Currently, I live with my brother. One of my brothers, he's in Chico with me. And he has his wife. So, and then my parents and then my older brother, they're in San Diego. But we try to get together during the holidays. And I have a cousin as well here. I guess it's the closest person that I had in family. And that's where we get together on Christmas. So we're like 10 people. I don't really have other family like this close. A lot of the people that live in Texas or Illinois. But yeah, we do a lot of the stuff, prepare food together like the day before. The presents, honestly, I don't think we've done presents for a while anymore. Occasionally, yeah, I like to give. So probably the people that I give would be my parents. Or my little cousins. But I don't expect to receive a present on Christmas. I just feel
you expect
like...
expect to eat.
Yeah. Yeah. I love food.
And dance.
I love food. Yeah, we do all the dancing, singing, eating, just mingling a lot of times, talking, catching up, because we don't see each other often, but...
What I'm wondering about, this is kind of a footnote, is do you think that there are less homeless Latinx people because there is this family support? I haven't seen any figures, but I wonder if that's true. Do you have an idea, Paul?
Yeah, that's an interesting question to pursue, but there's no doubt that I think that there seems to be like an extended family orientation amongst Latino families, particularly amongst people of Mexican origin, and so it's rare that, you know, when I grew up, my tias or my aunts would have a brother or a sister who would live with them. And so, yeah, I don't think that's a phenomenon that really impacts the Latino community that much at this point. Mm-hmm. To the benefit of the Latino culture, I think that it's one that's really very group-oriented. So that might play into that scenario.
And I think that's true of most. I mean, when I think of like Southern Europeans or, Asian Indians or something, Anglos seem to be pretty unique in being so isolated and nuclear family focused. Let's close by talking about Catholicism. That's another stereotype, that the majority of Latinx people are Catholic, although there's a growing evangelical movement all over South America. So who wants to speak to that? Were you all raised Catholic?
Actually, yes. I don't identify as being Catholic just because my connection with my faith and everything was with God himself, you know, like I speak.
Or herself.
Or herself. Yeah. No, yes, exactly. So, yeah, I always say I was raised Catholic. Like, that was what I was raised with. That's what my mom had taught me when I was growing up. I did go through catechism. I did do the confirmation and everything. I was baptized in the Catholic Church. But I always say I was raised Catholic. I never say I'm Catholic.
Maria.
I was raised Catholic, and I am Catholic. I don't necessarily agree with the history of the church, but that's a whole different story. Yeah, so I fall into that stereotype. I don't know if, you know, I can't speak for everyone else, but yeah, definitely faith is huge in my family. We've gone through, obviously, really ups and downs, really hard things, and so definitely I feel one of the things that has really kept us together is that going to church every weekend or before meals, praying, Thanksgiving,
saying grace,
yeah. And so, it's going to the different festivities that the church offers through the different times of the year. I think it really helps my family believe in something greater than ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Carlos, do you want to speak to that?
I guess I fall like as well as Karina. I was raised Catholic as well. I went through all the sacraments. I was baptized, First Communion, and then confirmation. Now that I'm like a little older, like I don't think I've gone to church as much. But I still have that faith. Like I believe in God himself or herself. And I do pray. I wouldn't necessarily say, I guess, pray the formal way. Yeah, but like my mom always tells me, like, as long as it comes from your heart,
yes.
You can talk to God all the time.
Yeah.
And so I do that often, like saying grace as well. And but I guess it's not a big part right now to go to church, but my family has that faith. Like, they believe in God, they pray. I guess a lot of the things is also like I don't agree with a lot of like organized religion in a way. I feel like it's just hard to like for me to see like money and church all that, and then why isn't it being used to help other people as much? But I mean, this is just my personal opinion.
Well, I think it's also the opinion of the Pope. We have a really progressive Pope who says Christianity's about helping the poor and being kind to people and not letting priests be pedophiles and whatever else. So he encourages me.
Yeah.
Except I haven't heard him say anything about women being ordained.
Mm-hmm.
I know he's saying that married men in South America could be priests where we need them, but I haven't heard him say women. So maybe that's next.
Hopefully.
Paul, do you want to address the Catholic question?
Sure. Similar to what they said, I was raised Catholic. I went to Catholic parochial school for about 9 years, but I have to be honest. I don't believe in God today. I would argue it's partly in response to my academic training. I consider myself a social scientist. I'm a sociologist, and so much of what I try to interpret in terms of my what I would call social reality is through factual-based information, and so I don't have anything against anybody being religious. I don't, you know, I'm not anti anything religious. If you want to believe in something, that's fine, but in terms of my own personal experience, I'm sure my mom's going to hear this, but, and my other family members, but no, I don't follow any religious practices whatsoever now.
You know, I'm writing this really interesting book about visionary scientists. They're people with PhDs and MDs, and we're talking about reality, the quantum physics and what's really real. And some of them say that experiences like synchronicity, like one of the guys named Gary Schwartz had 32 encounters with ducks. And it there was a metaphor in it. It wasn't just ducks. So having those kind of experience of synchronicity and being guided and precognition and having near-death experiences where you experience other dimensions, a lot of these people have ended up being really spiritual. And if you want to take a look, they're on my YouTube channel, the interviews with these guys. They're fascinating. So we have a minute left. Is there anything that anyone would like to say that we haven't addressed that we should?
So Carlos. So I want to speak about like a little bit of DACA. So there's actually a film about this, and a lot of my peers that I know one of the members that was in this film, and they also went to Washington for all this. It's called Waking Dream. So if anybody wants to see that, it talks about all the DACA recipients and behind their lives.
Where is it available? On YouTube?
I believe it's online. YouTube? Yeah, it's available on YouTube as well. So a lot of that, and we have also a school campus organization named LEAD, Leaders Educator for Advancement of Dreamers.
Wait, say that slower.
Leading